Monster Man, Episode 82, Bone Snapper to Buka. Stop missing with the Monster Man. It was a bad plan, but I had to get the town on it. Hey everybody, it's your old friend James from the future here with an exciting announcement. The second Monster Man contest, which I kept promising and postponing and promising and postponing, is go. We've got great prizes from backers like Spes Magna Games and Diplomatist Books, or you could win yourself a copy, a print copy, of The Hyqueous Vaults. So check out the rules for the contest. There's no miniatures this time. You're just going to make up a monster based on a list of AI-generated D&D monster names. It's going to be a ton of fun, and I will put a link to the contest entry rules in the show notes. So do check it out. Tell your friends. The first Monster Man contest was an amazing amount of fun, and I hope that the second one is going to be every bit as good. I now return you to your regularly scheduled podcast. Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and in this second season of Monster Man, I'm reading my way through the 1981 Fiend Folio supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons 1st Edition, and as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in it, their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. In this episode, we're talking about just two monsters from the B section of the Monster Manual. We're going to start with the Bone Snapper, and we're going to follow up with the Buka. But before we do that, let's take a time to read some listener mail. I got a couple of pieces of mail this week, and they all made me very happy. So let's take a look. Daniel Lofton posted on G+ about the episode about the Aliacs, and he pointed out that I got the mechanic that the Aliacs inflicts on you wrong. I said that you lose half your treasure, but that's not right. You lose half your experience points and all your treasure, which is significantly worse. I think I said half your treasure in the episode anyway. And even if you were able to kill it, you immediately go into service for your god for a year and a day, I think. So I think the conclusion out there, you know, people seem to agree with me that the Aliax is essentially a grudge monster. And I assume they further agree with me that grudge monsters are BS. Next, listener Goblin's Henchman sent in an email about the Blindheim, or possibly the Blindheim. And he asked, I wonder if Blindheim is a pun on blind him or blind him. Perhaps it would work better in a British accent. Yeah, that's possible. I could be wrong. I mean, I still think it's based on the place name. I think the famous historical location is definitely important. And finally, Sebastian Wakely pointed out a really interesting thing about the Burbalang, which is that there is a slight difference between the Burbalang as printed in the Fiend Factory column in White Dwarf number 11 and the version that appears in the Fiend Folio, and that is that in White Dwarf 11, the Burbalang can appear in as up to 24 Burbalangs. I had said in the episode that one of the differences between the Burbalang in the Fiend Folio and the folkloric Burbalang, I mean, apart from the obvious stuff, is that in the story that they come from, we get this whole village of Burbalangs, and that's not really how they work in the Fiend Folio, and Sebastian points out that that's much more possible under the incarnation that appeared in White Dwarf. Sebastian also pointed out the Fiend Factory range of miniatures, which you can check out on solegends.com. That's the Stuff of Legends, which is a website devoted to recording images of classic miniatures. And they're not all of the Fiend Factory stuff is in there. You know, the catalog is growing but not complete. But if you click on the Citadel 1980 catalog, you can see some images of the creatures from the Fiend Factory, some of which were kind of generic standard fantasy monsters, and some of which are things specifically from the Fiend Folio, including the Crabman, the Hook Horror, the Grell, the Carbuncle, and so on. Definitely worth taking a look at. Now, I do not own any of those Fiend Factory models, and my understanding is that they're pretty hard to come by, but I haven't really bothered to collect a lot of early 1980s Citadel stuff. I mostly have later miniatures in my collection. Just one or two pieces that I chanced on. Okay, thank you so much for writing in, everyone. It really means a lot to me to hear from my listeners, and I always learn something new. Let's talk then about today's monsters. Now, the Bone Snapper is yet another monster penned by Ian Livingstone, and like the other monsters that Livingstone wrote, it is basically an animal. The Bone Snapper is kind of a stubby little dinosaur. It's slightly short, well, it's about 5 feet tall, and it has a bite and a tail attack, and it's fierce and stupid. It says it's as stupid as it is aggressive. But there are a couple of interesting things. One thing I said about the Bone Snapper is that it's slightly duplicated by the Babbler. I mean, that it's just a small, kind of weird-looking dinosaur. And it's also like the Babbler in that it has a not game-relevant but weird and distinctive feature.
In the case of the babbler, it's the sounds that it makes. In the case of the bone snapper collects bones, specifically human jaw bones. And there's an enigmatic reference to the bone snapper collecting human jaw bones and keeping them in its lair. And the more jaw bones it has, the higher its status among bone snappers is. But they're just animals, really. So the idea that they have a kind of primitive intelligence and display a hierarchy is an intriguing one. One note that I found rather odd in the bone snapper, and that I found odd in dinosaurs and dinosaur-related monsters in general, is the insistence that the bone snapper is descended from long-extinct species of dinosaur. Like, we have a fantasy world where dragons exist, and there are orcs and magic and so on, but obviously dinosaurs existed in the past and don't exist today. And that just seems to be something that's taken for granted by every entry in either the Monster Manual or the Fiend Folio where dinosaurs show up in any way. It's just kind of a curious insistence on this one aspect of reality that doesn't seem all that relevant, but what do I know? Then we have the Buka, which is credited to Dungeons & Dragons co-creator Gary Gygax. Now, the Buka is what's also known as, I mean, I think most of us would think of it as a Puka, and like in Harvey, although the folkloric Puka is not really like the Puka in Harvey, other than that it's a human sometimes that has animal features. So the Buka is, do you remember when I said that a lot of the fairy tale creatures in the Monster Manual weren't very fairy tale-like? Well, here's Gary Gygax apparently filling in his own gap, because the Buka is very fairy tale-like. Bukas live in your house, and they might perform simple chores like sweeping, and if they see evil creatures, they might play a prank on them, but if you wrong them, then they will play mischievous tricks on you unless you give them a gift to placate them. One feature of the Buka that appears in a lot of folklore is that Bukas are shape changers. And they might appear in the form of an animal, or they might appear in the form of a person. Well, the person will often have some kind of animal feature, like horse ears or something that they can't conceal. And that's the giveaway that they're a Buka or a Puka. The root word appears to come from a word that means just spirit, and it's the same root word as, I think, if you look in A Midsummer Night's Dream, the mischievous fairy is Puck. And so Puck comes from the same root word as Buka. The Buka is an interesting creature because it is very similar to the kinds of fairy creatures that you get in fairy tales or in folk belief. That is to say, creatures that inhabit kind of everyday circumstances, right? So you think about a lot of fairy tales, they feature sort of homely motifs, you know, baking things in an oven, spinning, going to market to sell your cow, as sort of normal activities, even though they're turned into kind of a weird, grotesque thing by the context of the tale. And so the book is a little bit like that, right? It does household chores. It wants a gift. It's a little bit like, for those who have been listening to Patron Deities, the Fossagrim, which, you know, lives in a stream and will teach you to play the fiddle really well. This everyday normal homeliness of the Buka makes it something that is fun to encounter in a scenario set in a village or farm, but maybe not the point of the scenario, right? Like, Bukas are mischievous, not deadly. But if you know that there are Bukas that live in a house, you might be able to get some kind of useful information about them or get their help in an attempt to get rid of an evil spirit. Or, if you are in a place where there are a lot of Bukas, the fact that there are no Bukas in this house might turn out to be interesting, right? That might be a sign that something bad is there, since Bukas hate evil creatures. Bukas are good, they're kind of a nuisance, more than anything else. They're not a threat, they're a pain in the butt, and they might play a prank on you, but they don't really mean anything harmful by it. This is good because it gives characters the opportunity to interact with the Buka in a fairy tale-like manner, which is actually not so much the case for some of the other fairy-like creatures. Like, certainly when you think of how fairies act in fairy tales, it's not running up on people and stabbing them in the feet. What this means is that dealing with Bukas in a scenario presents a change of pace that nonetheless fits in, I think, pretty comfortably with a fantasy adventure setting. At least, you couldn't see Bukas turning up in Dark Sun, or at least not in this form. But with most kind of homely fantasy, I think they would fit quite well. And that's really one of the fantastic things about Bukas, and by extension, Dungeons & Dragons. That is, that they are creatures that essentially prompt you not just to kind of change how your characters think about interacting with them, but almost to actually change genres. Something that the game is actually pretty good at, and that I think later games tended to be more focused on emulating a specific play experience, which often meant that they did one genre or one style of play much more effectively than Dungeons & Dragons, but were more vulnerable to kind of being derailed by changes in how you played them. Or at least, that's kind of the sense I'm getting here. It's a little bit like a classic TV adventure show where we might have, you know, a mystery episode one week, and then a comedy episode the next, you know, and then a very serious character-centered drama the week after that. And maybe there is an intentional aspect to this in the variety of creatures that we see in the Monster Manual. Now, next episode, we are finally getting to one of the monsters I've been looking forward to the most in this whole podcast. Yes, of course, I'm talking about my froggy boys, the Bullywugs. And in addition to that, we're going to talk about the Bunyip, which I think is our first creature from Australian mythology. So please don't miss the next episode of Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the Deities and Demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.